have liked some of his works over the year, but it's actually a true story. It was sort of the ending of my desire to be in the rock and roll business, and I actually got my library degree here at the UW not long afterwards. I just want to thank Sam and Patrick Feaster for allowing me to speak today. This is my first ARSC conference in my old hometown, and welcome. I also want to do a shout out to a colleague of mine at Syracuse, because it's her stalwart championing of the Belfer Archive, and that's, of course, Sue Stinson. Yeah. It has really been her passion and her bedrock approach to this wonderful world of sound archives that allowed my more entrepreneurial spirit to sort of float above it and gave me an anchor, and provided really the ability for me to create what I'm going to give in my paper today, which is, I hope, going to be an interesting reevaluation of how we might approach copyright, and at least how we've been doing it to date at Syracuse. It's fitting that I follow David's talk on Naxos' decision today, because it shows there are many paths leading to a possible loosening of the copyright laws that govern recorded music. And certainly changing the laws is one valid path we must keep in mind, not least to unify the patchwork of state laws that now govern copyright. It is also the first step in encouraging Congress, perhaps, to deal with the issue more holistically at the federal level, which is one of the mandates, of course, of the National Recording Preservation Board. But to my mind, the problem with seeking a purely legal avenue to alleviate our copyright challenges is that jurisprudence, and indeed the legislators who make the laws, are in fact a fickle cadre. And the winds can blow either way, notably when you consider the clout of the music industry lobby in Congress, as opposed to our meager .edu resources. There is no guarantee, of course, that new laws will be any better, thinks Sonny Bono. The approach that Syracuse University has taken, however, is very different, seeking not so much to change the quilt work of confusing laws, but rather to engage the industry directly to mutual benefit. What we've striven to do is to find common ground between archives and industry to formulate, through a memorandum of agreement, a music rights service model that protects the intellectual property and revenues of the industry and the artists on the one hand, while providing archives the ability to digitize significant portions of their and our unique collections and our important catalogs for preservation, pedagogy, research, and artistic discovery. We are blessed at SU, perhaps unlike some other schools, by having one of the country's preeminent music industry programs, to which many of the top executives from both coasts have been invited speakers. Even for the topmost executives, their stint at SU usually lasts about 2 days, with a visit to the Belfer Audio Archive. But what they get, in part, is a chance to tell their story to a willing audience. The students also get to hear that the music business isn't all about 2 martini lunches and midnight bashes, but is in reality a cutthroat enterprise in the throes of traumatic change. In many ways, this is, as some of you must realize, a new model of industry recruitment. And in fact, as I was coming down here with a musician friend of mine, he said, "Oh, what do they learn there? How to, you know, cut a cake of cocaine and you know, the usual industry hack that we can imagine." But I can assure you that's not what SU is doing. Indeed, Marty Bandier, CEO and founder of EMI, a company that is one of the world's largest entertainment conglomerates, is a trustee on the Syracuse University Board of Governors. And through his largesse, I believe to a tune of well into the 8 figures, has launched the renaming of our music industry program, to which I will attend the inaugural in about 2 weeks in New York. Like I say, in part because Syracuse has built over the years this wide-ranging relationship with top players in the industry, we've also been in a position at Syracuse to approach these men, and I'm glad to say now a growing number of women, to join us in a dialogue about their back catalogs. And I'm really referring here to sort of Edison to 1960, which are housed in analog formats, most comprehensively and jointly in our university and library archives. Think the Rigler Deutsch universe and et cetera. But also let us remember held by the industry in commercial vaults such as Iron Mountain in Pennsylvania. Through these dialogues we've had, we are seeing if we can come to common ground on providing access, e.g. digital access, to this vast and varied corpus. Now, we're not so foolish as to believe, and our conversations with these companies have shown, that if there isn't something in it for them, and by them I mean Sony BMG, Universal, Warner Music, EMI, to name a few, but without something in it for them, we can hardly expect they will have much interest in this dialogue. Spending valuable time shooting the breeze with a bunch of academic types prattling on about mom, apple pie, and American heritage of music isn't going to get them in the heartstrings, I can assure you. They might give these noble sentiments passing lip service, and the higher you go in the company, the more lip service you get, and the lower you get, the more hurdles you find, and I can speak to that later. But these companies are big businesses first and foremost, and are more than anything about the bottom line. Unless you've had your head in the sand these past 10 years, you've doubtly noticed the litigious strong arm of RIAA is everywhere present, which pretty much tells you at a stroke that the music industry ain't about apple pie, Lawrence Welk notwithstanding. It was actually in a conversation a year or so back with Tim Brooks, who introduced me, that the reality of the diametrically opposite cultures between industry and archive was made plain to me. I'm indebted to Tim for driving home an important point. By the time he and I had spoke on the phone, we at Syracuse had already had several conversations with key industry players, not least Kerry Sherman at RIA, and found a modestly supportive response. But it was something that Tim said on the phone that day that helped us to reframe the conversation with industry in a different light, and in the end, to mutual benefit. What Tim said was, and I'm paraphrasing, if you approach the industry, you absolutely must have a business model on the table that they will understand. And that, of course, made brilliant sense. So in a sense, we duly created a business model in concert with several retired VIPs in the music industry, several top-tier policy experts, even a former president of RIA thrown in for good measure. In creating this business model, we realized that if we hope to approach our aims at collective digitization with any measure of success, we would likely succeed far better if we partnered with business in the enterprise from the start than if we tried to go it alone without their input. David today talked eloquently about one approach in the Naxos case. While Syracuse is supportive in principle that music copyright laws must evolve into more liberal and cohesive federal dominance, our path to date has avoided any hint of litigation. What we have done, as noted, is to seek partnership with industry, and thereby, we hope, make their analog back catalogs available to a wider public in digital format. These analog catalogs are retained in formats such as cylinders, 78s, 45s, and LPs. I don't have to tell anyone in this room about that. Now, it's worth noting that the Belfer Archive has not only a preeminent collection of recorded sound, but one of the finest historical collections of recording and playback equipment in the country. So we know only too well that while the recordings themselves may not self-destruct like acidic paper, magnetic tape is something else I understand, but as I say, the recordings may last a while longer yet, but our playback equipment sure won't. Parts for all sorts of historical equipment become increasingly harder to find, as you all know, with each passing year. These fears, therefore, are partly what spurs us on to make our analog collections available digitally. And to do this, we are spurred to design a copyright service model that sidesteps litigation but offers a partnership with industry, where together we can co-manage our digital assets in a new business model of cooperation. The devil's in the details. And I need tell no one in this room that with the music industry revenues tanking year after year, with their thundering and litigious antagonisms against piracy everywhere in the news, with top execs blaming their misfortunes on criminal kids at their laptops instead of their own hidebound business models in many cases, with all this going on, we do realize only too well that sitting down with suspicious industry execs will not be an easy task. Talk of digitizing their back catalogs has all the earmarks of yet another whinnying horse galloping out of their unlocked stables, saddlebags of loot and revenue with them. So the business model we propose looks something like this. Instead of seeking to change copyright law, which frankly is as confusing to the industry in many respects as it is mystifying to us, we said, let's broker a service model to release copyrights in a win-win for everybody, where industry can make a buck on their old music, while archives and educational enterprise that we represent can have unfettered access for our users, thus fostering preservation, pedagogy, research, and artistic discovery. And we will accomplish this by building a digital repository with archive and industry in concert, akin somewhat to iTunes, but with one singular difference. We propose that this repository have two access modes, not one, as in Apple's iTunes. And when I speak of a repository, I do not mean one huge central database, but a distributed network of interconnected institutional repositories, all working together under the same memorandum of agreement with the industry. So what's the repository architecture actually look like? Well, on the one hand, we would have the industry's front end, a music shopping mall, if you will, where MP3-like music objects can be purchased by the public via online downloads at prices set by the industry itself. The model has been very well tested by iTunes, wildly successful, which currently retains a virtual monopoly in this arena, though bigger giants such as Google and Microsoft, so I've heard, are trying to get in on the fray. What's different, as I say, is that we provide another entrance to this same repository network. The same identical catalog of digital music, mind you, but access on our end, the archive end, would be granted under fair use via streaming technology. Doubtless, and it's streaming, of course, prevents the theft of the digital object. Doubtless, access would have to be limited at first by authentication schema to .edu domain holders, but in time we believe that industry will see little threat from the streaming side and open up access to a wider audience. But with recorded music on our side available only in streaming mode, with firewalls built into the system to protect any possibility of illegal file sharing, the understandable fears of the industry that this back door will let all kinds of kids into their candy store is obviated. To our mind, streaming works just fine for pedagogy and research, easily piped into classrooms across campus and onto desktops in faculty and research offices at the click of a mouse. Anyone who hears a cool oldie and wants a copy clicks on the industry front end and you can buy the song for a buck or whatever the market price settles on. Even the industry can understand that providing the very kids who are today pirating Britney Spears or the Red Hot Chili Peppers from their dorm rooms, if they are also given fair use access to the cool older stuff we are digitizing, it might make honest citizens of them yet. Same repository, different front ends. So what benefits accrue to the industry? Well, there are many. For one, in this model, and this is one of the key and important points I'm going to make, is that the cost of this mass digitization is borne by the archive world, not the industry. Through a variety of sources, direct institutional help from our universities, possibly the government, also from granting agencies of every stripe, from mega corporations like Google and Microsoft. And if you think of the Google Five and their desire to digitize 10 million books at Michigan, Stanford, and Oxford, you understand that Google wants to get into the digitization of the older stuff that they can then wrap around their company logo and so forth. They're all hell-bent on acquiring any sort of digital content. But there are also quirky billionaires like David Packard of the Packard Humanity Institute that's helped Sam out with the Culpeper Center, and even perhaps Paul Allen here in Seattle. Are the Packards of the world interested? Well, I've been to Menlo Park, where the PHI is, to talk to the PHI's chief financial officer, Bob Mellish, to float this idea. It helps, of course, that he's an SU alum. But he, at least, was intrigued. The plus here is that the music business gains access to their own back catalog collections in digital format at no cost to themselves. And that's a key ingredient, and not a shabby carrot, either. They can thus cherry-pick the best material using download data and repackage the more desirable stuff in box sets or what have you. How they market it, then, is their rightful business. But in time, it will be based on hard data, not on blind hopes that nostalgia alone will open people's wallets. So we will digitize the industry's back catalogs, selectively, of course, at no cost to them, providing the industry with a wonderful way to limit their costs while maximizing their possible revenues. Secondly, in our repository model, as noted, industry gets hard purchase data from download patterns with which to gauge the public wallet. Finally, as more and more people, and artists especially, hear this old music for the first time, industry will find a growing market of musicians interested in commercially re-recording this wonderful old stuff. I mean, think Rod Stewart reinventing his career in Las Vegas if he could actually hear what we have in our archives. But here, too, is another potential revenue stream for the copyright holders and for the publishing industry. Doubtless, all these revenue streams will be modest at first, but in aggregate, potentially lucrative, as has been noted in other media. Think of the used out-of-print book market and, for example, auctions that go on eBay. It's all old stuff. Secondhand bookstores are booming today because of online access through Abe and Libris, whereas independent booksellers selling current material can't go up against Amazon, Barnes & Nobles, and Borders. So providing online access to the older stuff is a lucrative market, and I think the music industry is beginning to see that. And all of it, of course, is going to help their bottom line. And last but not least, there's the brilliant and positive PR bonanza which the industry will bask in if they sign on to some sort of semblance of this business model. Consider what it would be like for them. Instead of seeing the Rhea henchmen and copyright cops hauling some poor 12-year-old Puerto Rican girl, as happened on the front page of the New York Times several years ago, off in chains, we look at the corporations as bullies. Imagine if the industry were instead basking the kudos of a grateful public. The mainstream press would be all over it like a cheap suit, headlining that the bad guys of yesterday are now the collaborative darlings of today, finally doing the right thing. Can you see the smiling music execs shaking the hands of a half a dozen university presidents, smiling photos blazed on the front page of Billboard, the New York Times entertainment section, and possibly even the Chronicle of Higher Education? Certainly in talks with Marty Bandier of EMI, for one, I can assure you he'd die and go to heaven for that chance of PR bonanza. Okay, so life, I am well aware, is never so rosy. But before I pop my own bubble, which I will shortly, let's now review the benefits to us guys, that is, to the archive music collector world. Well, instead of butting up against endless copyright hurdles, one song at a time, we seek instead to bridge these hurdles with the very industry that holds the copyright in the first place. Are there copyright service models out there whereby revenues make their way back to rightful owners of intellectual property, while at the same time providing wide and free access to educators, research, and students? Well, there are several models, none of them exact to the issue in hand, but they can be molded, morphed, and changed, and used to our benefit. The models are actually out there in spades, from the Creative Commons, whose top two links this week actually are all about music, to Harvard's Copyright Commons, to commercial companies like Snowcap, who'll do the dirty work of digging for rights holders for you, for a fee, of course. But to my mind, we get miles ahead of where we are now if we approach copyright clearance in a joint partnership with industry that looks something like what I've described, rather than the endless hand-wringing we've indulged in to date. Or let a company like Loudeye, perhaps, and Loudeye is the company that parcels out the money every time you listen to a song at Barnes & Noble's or Borders, and you put it under that scanner, it goes into a system, and a nickel goes back. Barnes & Noble pays a nickel, but Loudeye manages that nickel and gives it a penny here and a penny there and manages the rights and gives money back to the companies that allow this free access to this music in the music store. So there's lots of models out there. Secondly, building on the excellent research done in the reports CLEAR put out by the likes of June Besick and Tim here and others at the behest of the National Recording Preservation Board, add to these the ongoing catalog inventory work being done by many of you in this very room as you seek to gain better access to your archival collections. Armed with these, we can gauge far better what collections each archive might want to digitize first without fear of copyright infringement reprisal. We can build a collaborative yet institutionally distinct set of interlinked repositories all connected in some fashion to the same business model and build them with the blessing of the very industry that now appears to thwart us. As long as the business and copyright service model remains somewhat intact, each archive can create their back-end streaming site any which way they want, each to their own. Furthermore, in any deal we broker with the industry, we can negotiate a nickel on every dollar made on the commercial side for upkeep and expansion of our own digital repositories, brokered by some middleman, some 501(c) middleman, and I'll talk about that in a minute. After all, it is the business model. These revenues may not be excessive, but they could be significant enough to cover basic costs of repository upgrade and administration, and could be parceled out through some sort of algorithm to all the partners in the consortium. Finally, though by no means the end of an exhausted list of possible benefits, but finally, as I say, the nightmare of copyright, largely set aside by industry's direct involvement in our partnership, may provide a better chance for us to go and do our ask. And by ask, of course, I mean our request for funding from agencies that dole out the cash, whatever their stripe, from government sponsors like NEH or IMLS, to foundations like Carnegie Mellon or the Ira Wallace, to corporate partnerships, to the deep pockets of rich donors like Packard or Paul Allen. And maybe even our university presidents might cough up some money. All well and good. But alas, this fairy tale has its goblins, and I'm not so Pollyannish to assume there are no road bumps ahead, or that in the end the model might not morph into something entirely different. We've talked to all sorts of people now in the industry, and I'll talk briefly about that and then hopefully leave some time for questions. But there was one VP of a major conglomerate's back catalog who we visited in New York City. We sat, me and my colleagues from Syracuse, in his magnificent office, offices over Park Avenue with the Chrysler Building in the distance, and we chatted about this. He was extremely interested. In fact, we left with high fives all round and sacks of freebie CDs bestowed upon us by his munificence, and he said he just loved our business model. His last words were before parting that he'd have one of the company's top lawyers, call us soon. Well, that's never a good sign, I'm sorry to say, David, but it certainly put a crimp in our style as we were leaving with these big bags of free CDs.
But you got to keep the CD.
Well, little did I know that when they did call, in fact, the other line was actually a conference call with not just one company lawyer, but three company lawyers. They'd set the hound dogs on us. And we weren't 2 minutes into what I thought was going to be a follow-up to our amenable talk in New York with the VP when these watchdogs lit into a harangue that maybe, just maybe, this big company would play in our sandbox if in return the likes of Syracuse University would sign on to their anti-piracy programs and yada-da-yada-da-yada-da. They wouldn't let up. So even in our discussions, we've realized they're interested, and as I've said, the higher we go in discussions with CEOs and high vice presidents, they're interested. It's as you get lower to the lawyers, to the people on the ground, that you suddenly see the roadblocks. But our feeling is that by working with the topmost executives, the pressure then will come down. The point being, though, is that the companies, even that all of them that we've talked to, and we've talked to most of the majors and several of the labels, they're going to play hardball, and we're very aware of that, interested as they are, because they're not capitalizing on their back catalogs. And in a sense, we are, although for the most part, we provide analog access. Furthermore, as my friend Sam Berlowski, your future arts president, likes to remind me every time we talk on this topic, and I'll paraphrase him, you'll never get all these big industry types into the same room, and besides, if you did, there are antitrust considerations to think about. Well, Sam's right. We've considered the downsides of what that smoke-filled room might look like to the Justice Department as the big boys supposedly connive, collude, and price fix. Well, with all due respect, I beg to differ. We've raised the issue with all the big companies, and given the nature of the discussions on the table, their lawyers, so far, don't see a problem. Indeed, we have already sat in the same room with a significant number of them, albeit over a delightful lunch, with four disparate and high-placed pairs in the industry, plus the former president of RIAA. The luncheon was most cordial and encouraging, so we feel there's traction here for an inclusive approach rather than a company-by-company series of separate discussions. Furthermore, the antitrust concerns raised by the former RIAA president at the luncheon itself, who is himself a lawyer, of course, became moot when talk turned to a proposal that an honest consortial broker might serve as middleman in our project. For example, an umbrella org like the Mellon Foundation-backed Ithaca, which is a sort of umbrella organization that manages digital assets and certainly university assets that are being digitized and so forth. Or any, in fact, 501c3 broker that might serve as the honest middleman managing the repository licensing. Then, having the industry players all at one table is little different than any other trade association meeting with its members of individual companies discussing industry-wide benefits important to them all. One could even suggest offering the commercial front end to a Steve Jobs, et cetera, if Apple were willing to promote it as a separate iTunes for oldies. There would be no collusion on the price set on the commercial side for the simple reason that each record company could set their own price per song on the downloads. There's much more to tell and many facets that I have not covered, nor in the end do we at Syracuse claim that this business model is some overarching panacea. Rather, it's a place to start a new conversation. Nor do we believe for a minute that we have every answer to the questions and challenges that may and doubtless will arise. Clearly, we're largely making this up as we go along and tailoring our thinking the more we talk with the industry and setting new courses as the dialogue evolves. As we begin to winnow who really must be at the table, we're beginning to sort of get a sense of who those might be. Is it the publishers like Harry Fox? Is it the record labels? Big industry giants only? RIAA, of course, ASCAP, and et cetera, or the editors of some of the major music press, Billboard being one of them. Well, maybe it is, maybe it's not. We've certainly talked to most of these organizations, companies, and labels. There are many labels and companies, but clearly we're learning as we go. But so far, we have not met a music exec who doesn't think that this theory and this business model they believe that it has legs. None of them to date have thrown us out on our keister. And it's been heartening, at least so far. We are cognizant that deciding on the right cadre of industry players is one of our biggest hurdles ahead. But the challenge isn't all in picking the right mix of industry players. Among archives too, like it or not, there's an equal heritage of institutional gamesmanship and envy. All of us in this room may believe we share a common belief in the inalienable benefits of copyright clearance, but the fact is, when we go home to our respective institutions, our allegiances will soon revert back to our institutional loyalties to the universities and companies that pay our salaries. Indeed, agreement on an appropriate business model among the folks in this very room may be the hardest sell of all. Harder, in fact, than working with the industry. So where are we in our negotiations? We've spoken directly to four of the biggest of the corporations, several record labels, peripherally with Harry Fox, and we will probably be following that conversation up in New York shortly, and on several occasions with the RIAA. We also have the interest of the music press. In fact, Ray Conniff's daughter, Tamara, was at one of our luncheons. She's the editor of Billboard, and she loved our idea. And we will be going back to LA and DC to have further conversations. LA so far has just been on the phone. To date, we've shared our thinking and some of conference calls with the archive world, and included in those have been the Library of Congress, the New York Public, Santa Barbara, and a few others on the archive side to see what synergies exist and what concerns lay ahead. This group is by no means exhaustive, nor is it intended to be exclusive, but it does represent a thoughtful balance of government archive in Washington, a public archive in New York City, a state institution north of LA, always useful, and a private university in Syracuse. Again, representative of our world, but not exclusive by any means. We have also been in close contact with the NRPB and members of its board, but whatever benefits accrue from the memorandum of agreement we may be able to broker with the industry, these benefits will be open to all. That's our intention. Though some sort of institutional signing on to the memorandum of agreement will likely be required, both by the honest broker and by the industry. What that may look like in the end, we do not exactly know at this time, but the intention to provide the widest benefit to all archives resides at the hearts of this project. Our hope is that someday soon we can convene a meeting between the industry, and that would include major players that I've mentioned in my paper, and the archives, probably the ones mentioned, but there may be others, at Syracuse's brownstone presence in New York City called Lubin House on East 61st Street, a stone's throw from most of the industry offices, as well as the Mellon Foundation, with whom we've spoken to positively about funding the summit. Will it happen? Too early to tell. But to date, the signs are encouraging, the input's been dynamic, and the interest universal. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
I won't tell them that at the next luncheon. Yeah. Yeah, it's representative, and clearly we're. Well, we have self-interest here. Syracuse University is a major institution. It's a corporate enterprise. We do have a music industry program. These are players we know and have worked with. But once, in the memorandum we see brokering, we want it to be widely open to as many different and disparate entities as possible, not just the .edu domain. And I think we would negotiate that to some degree. And in the run-up to the summit, if indeed it occurs, and I have every belief it will, certainly industry seems interested, we will have wider discussions than that this little group. But if you're going to get the industry into one room, they don't want 40 of you guys on the other side glaring at them. Believe me, they want a small, quote-unquote, representative cadre. And for that reason, we've kept it somewhat, you know, small. But the intention is, and I said it in my paper, to have as wide a benefit through the memorandum. Yeah, in the back. Yeah, blue shirt. Well, yeah, if we are to digitize this material through this model or any other, we're going to have to come up with the money ourselves anyway. This model does provide revenue, and if the bugaboo of copyright is somewhat alleviated or largely alleviated, certainly foundations that we've spoken to, I'll use Mellon, are willing, much more willing, to fund this sort of project when they don't see litigation coming from giving money to digitize large and selective areas of our important archives. So the model provides the industry with an ability to cherry pick their own analog assets now digitized by us. So what? Good for them. But if it also provides a way for us to work with industry to get around the difficulties of copyright clearance, and the difficulties don't go away, it's just the benefit is much more if industry's on your side. I sort of lost my train of thought, but anyway, the model doesn't actually lay out a different way of funding that we would have to find in the first place. And the fact that the industry might have some benefit to them actually gets them, it's one carrot that gets them to the table. You and then you.
And I can imagine a situation where a music scholar might want to look at that digital file more closely and in a better quality than
You know, we're looking at the long term here, and this is a perfectly valid question. Just for the record, Syracuse has a huge spoken word collection. So, you know, we're very aware that it's a diverse audience, and you all have archives with a lot of different stuff. What we're trying to do is to get the industry to the table. We want to get our camel's nose under the tent flap. We want to be able to at least have the dialogue, which we are having now. And once they see that the horses aren't going to be leaving their stable with the revenue sacks on their back, and they're actually going to start making a little money from this plan, I think over, I don't have a crystal ball, few years, they're going to, the more access, we're finding it in journal literature, the more access, the more people want that journal literature, even if initially it's free. And I think the industry doesn't get that. And, you know, my grandfather held a spear when Caruso sang in Philadelphia in early part of the last century. I would buy that song no matter what if it was in some archive for $1.50. So if I could hear it, I'm going to buy it. You know, the free access is not going to keep that dollar in my pocket. You probably all have similar interests and experiences. But we feel that if we can get them to the table, the door will begin to open. And they're going to change their thinking from this paranoia because they're losing money on Britney Spears to realizing that Shirley Temple's first song, there's not a big market. Or, you know, an early broadcaster or some poet or whatever. You can go from the music industry to the broadcast industry. And if you wanted to digitize some of your, you know, radio shows from the 30s or whatever, if the model works, then, you know, there won't be a copyright on the model. Yeah, somebody in the back. Right. And armed with real download data, they can really start repackaging it. I mean, when I talked to this VP of their back catalog, you know, he said, a lot of the stuff I choose to do and our company chooses to do is sort of vanity. It's sort of nostalgia, and it doesn't sell for beans. And then they do one little box set, and it sells wild, and they can't figure it out. But if you can see longitudinal trends from download data, you can package stuff. Maybe it's by genre, maybe it's by instrument, maybe it's by, you know, hillbilly music, maybe it's gospel. Yeah. You know, if we can really start to get some serious money to start digitizing, we gain better access. I mean, if you got money to digitize, I mean, we have, Sue can correct me, but many, many thousand Latin music 45s. They're not in any system. But if we got, you know, $1 million, Dave Packard wrote us a check, you know, he'd had a couple of martinis, and bang, we were going to digitize them, there's going to be bibliographic control of suddenly tens of thousands of 45s. That is a boon to everybody, to scholars, to classrooms, to you know, artists that might want to re-record this material. So yeah, I mean, I agree that I think there's it's kind of a exponential growth here if this can take off. One more question.
The
Well, we'll negotiate a quarter on every dollar. How about that instead of a nickel?
David had one more thing to add here.
I just wanted to, I mentioned earlier, that was a very interesting discussion, by the way. I mentioned Professor Lessig's book, and I just want to, in case people were interested in a book that would contextualize Naxos and this issue in the larger intellectual property law context. Professor Lessig's second book is called The Future of Ideas, and his most recent book is called Free Culture. And Free Culture is probably the one I'd recommend the most, not only because it's the most recent, but it also is, I think, is the broadest. So I just wanted to recommend that as further reading to kind of get a sense of where I'm coming from and more of what I was talking about.
Thanks. Larry's great. I recommend you read him. Just brilliant mind.
Thank you very much for a fascinating session.
Thank you.